Welcome to the Indie Authors Podcast. I'm Chad Robert Morgan, multi-award-winning author of The Baby Eater, amongst other books. So, the reason I purposely bring up The Baby Eater is because one of the first things we want to talk about today is the three tenets of psychological horror. So let's start at the beginning. So you tell me, what is scary? What makes a horror novel a horror novel? Welcome to the Indie Authors Podcast. I'm Chad Robert Morgan, multi-award winning author of The Baby Eater, amongst other books. So the reason I purposely bring up The Baby Eater is because one of the first things we want to talk about today is the three tenets of psychological horror. So let's start at the beginning. So you tell me, what is scary? What in a horror movie is scary? What do they put in horror movies to
terrify? Sound design, odd visual techniques. Things that are not in books.
Okay, but more specifically, what sound techniques that they put in? What is it that they are doing to make you scary? There's sound techniques in sci-fi. There's sound techniques in fantasy. What are the sound techniques in horror that instills a sense of horror?
There's just a classic thing like...
Okay, but so let's talk about the building of suspense. So what builds suspense? What are we being suspenseful of? Okay, let's start with that. Okay, killing somebody. Okay. Well, see, that's one of the reasons why horror movies are so successful. Okay, is because it's one of the few genres that crosses over all cultures and economic positions and anything else, right? Because we basically all have the same fears. That's why, for example, comedy is much harder. Look at like the IT Crowd, for example. Love the IT Crowd, British comedy show, right? But there are some jokes there that just don't land for me because they're specific to what's going on in England, right? Like there's this whole bit where they changed their version of 911, and so it's this big long number that's like a page long, and they're dialing in 1-2-9-4, you know, while the place is on fire, right? And not being from England, I don't have the reference, I don't have the context, so it doesn't land for me as an American. Horror, universal. You're worried about the monster coming up to you because we're all afraid of death. We're all afraid of dying. We're all afraid of somebody close to us dying. We're afraid of suffering pain. We're afraid of being disfigured. That's universal. Doesn't matter if you're American or British or Iranian or Israeli or Chinese. We all have it, right? That's just part of being human. And that kind of unites us. But what we're going to talk about right now goes beyond the superficial and go deep down into the more psychological tenets of horror, okay? So there was a really nice YouTube channel known as Extra Credits, right? Are they still around? Well, they would do these deep dives into various topics. And there's a whole series that they've done on horror. But the one that I kept going back to when working on my own projects was this kind of distillation of the three tenets of horror, of psychological horror, that I try to incorporate in my own. Because when you get to that kind of horror, where you're, like I said, everybody's afraid of the guy coming at you with the butcher knife, right? Because we're afraid of dying.
The guy with the butcher knife.
Yes. But things like The Shining that gives you nightmares like 3 days after you watch it. That's a whole different kind of horror. Forget the movie. Look at the original book. How many people died in the original book? One person. And he was the villain.
Yep.
Basically.
In the books, in parentheses, for all the people who just... In parentheses, only Jack dies in the book.
Right.
Everyone else survives.
Because Scatman Carruthers' character, DeCalloran, yeah. Does not originally die in the movie.
No, he dies in the movie,
he does not... Does not die in the book. He dies in the movie, but he does not die in the book. And in fact, even the movie still only has two deaths, which is a low body count for a horror movie.
Yep.
Right?
Movies.
But the movie was terrifying, not just because of the fear of death, but because of the psychological that it instilled in people. And there's a whole documentary about what... Stanley Kubrick did in the movie to just mess with people's heads, right? Like layouts of the hotels that physically could not exist, just to mess with people's senses of perception. Really crazy, but we're in a book, so let's talk about the three things that really gets deep-rooted horror going into the things that are going to keep you up at night, right? So getting back to the zero punctuation video, Daisy instilled a bunch of Jungian psychology, and so I'm distilling it from there. So this is like the purest extract of this topic. But there's three pillars that if you hit, it's just going to really do a gut punch. And that is the self, the uncanny, and the other. Okay? So, let me put it to you. What would be an idea of the self?
Okay, so I'm guessing I hate how I look. It's so like a creature who has no face appeal.
Nope.
Okay. And himself. You didn't say something I don't know anything about and be like, what do you think about this topic? And I'm like, no, I have no idea what it is. How do you expect me to answer?
Oh no. But I mean, this is sort of like a back and forth and a discussion. I include you in the conversation instead of like talking by myself.
Feel for me. It's like.
Yeah. Are we gonna just redo this?
No.
All right.
Not at all. Nope. Not any of that. You can't make me.
Okay. So the self is the own person's deep issues. Okay. For example, let's look at Jack Torrance, right? Going back to The Shining. This is a guy who literally was battling his own demons. And what was his major demon in the book?
Alcoholism.
Alcoholism. Right. So, well, not only that, but he also had a history of abuse, yeah, especially when he was drunk. Okay. So, but he was battling his own demons, and the ghosts of the hotel were using that to his advantage. They were literally giving him like ghost alcohol to get him back on the sauce. They were using that. So, and in the book, well, I mean, but in the book, he has to conquer his own demons in order to save Danny, right? Which, again, is different than the movie, because in the movie, he doesn't conquer his demons, and he falls to them, right? He winds up losing, right? He's chasing after them in the snow. He gets lost and he dies. But in the book, if I remember right, cause it's been a while since I read it, but at the very last minute, because there's like, oh, you forgot to check the boiler. He had to check the boiler every so often to keep exploding, right? From he runs down there. He's going, oh, the boiler. He runs down there. And at the very last minute, he's like, oh, no, I can let this explode and save my family. And so he purposely lets it go, right? So at the very last minute, he's able to conquer his demons. That's the kind of self that we're talking about. You have to deal with your own personal demons. So as another example, look at the main character in Silent Hill 2.
I love Silent Hill 2. I'm so different. I love Silent Hill. Because of its emotionally complex.
You know, they're supposed to be making a remake.
It's good.
Well, the HD remaster was horrible. But this is actually supposed to be a remake from the...
So, like Resident Evil.
Sort of. Yeah. So, but look at the main character, Silent Hill 2, right? Because he's going on this path where he has to face a doppelganger of his wife. As goes through, he's facing literal physical manifestations of his own guilt coming back at him. That's always what made Silent Hill so memorable and gut-wrenching, because it was, well, but it is the self incarnate, right? His own personal things, like his own sexual frustration because he couldn't be with his wife. That's why the nurses are all like sexing in skimpy outfits, because it's his own issues with that being thrown back at him. When you get to the end and you realize that he is responsible for his wife's death and why he's responsible for his wife, that's when it starts branching to multiple endings, and it's like, does he conquer his own demons and fall to them? Right? So that's the idea of self, of the character's own issues being thrown back at him, right? Of holding a mirror to the person in the book. The second pillar, probably the easiest one to understand, is the idea of the other, something that is so different that it's frightening, right?
Like Cthulhu.
Cthulhu's a good one, yeah. Cthulhu is more than just the other. That also brings up another topic, which is not one of the pillars, but the idea of helplessness, right? Like, it's one thing to say that the killer is, like, there's a really good scene in the second It movie where he's trying to save the boy and he's trapped in, like, mirror maze. And he can't reach the boy, and he's watching Pennywise come up behind the boy, and he's totally helpless to save him, right? That was actually one of the issues I had when I was working on Silent Hill Homecoming. Because Silent Hill 2, the main protagonist, was not very good at combat. The whole struggling with combat was actually a game design. In the third one, you play a little girl. Well, not a little girl. You're playing a young girl.
In the next one, you're a dude who's like been in his house for a really long time. He's not fighting.
Well, but worse than that, they had this mechanic where they had ghosts you couldn't kill, which I found very annoying as a gameplay mechanic.
In the fourth one, yeah.
Okay. So you had to collect these swords, and these swords you could pin the ghost. Right. But you only had so many of them, so in order to use it again, you had to unpin one ghost to pin the next ghost, and then half the game is like an escort mission, because you got this neighbor that you're escorting, and she's hobbling along and her arms in a sling and the whole nine yards and everything like that. So it's not like you just race through it, because you got to make sure that the girl gets through safely, right? With Homecoming, he comes back as a combat vet with PTSD. You know, like, they had a dodge roll mechanic. And I was telling the gameplay designers, this is not scary, right? If you can dodge out of the way and bring up the knife and do it, that's not scary. That what makes it scary is the lack of empowerment.
Like, this isn't Resident Evil.
Well, even Resident, yeah. Well, that was part of the problem, was Konami wanted Resident Evil.
It doesn't help that later on in Resident Evil, it becomes kind of one, like, with the RE. Which one was the, which one? But in the Nemesis remake, didn't they, like, kind of?
I don't know, but they brought it back with Biohazard, and then the last one with Village.
Oh, Village and Biohazard were good. Those were really good.
Right.
But they screwed up the Nemesis one, because I'm pretty sure, like, you can one-shot with a grenade launcher.
But the funny thing is that with Biohazard, we went from an action-adventure to being helpless again. Like, there was a whole bit where you're trying to escape the table, and you're having to run and hide. There was a lot of evasion, of being helpless, of not being able to fight back. So that is actually what made the whole Cthulhu story so terrifying, was at the end of it, they're ramming their boat into Cthulhu, knowing it's not going to make a difference. I'm going to pause it, because I'm going to cover the bird, because it's going to make noise again.
Okay.
Just wait.
So who's ended this, aka me?
I'm going to eat the thing up. I'm going to bring you to death. I hate you. 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 I hate you.
Yo.
Be careful where you sleep tonight.
I'm going to cut to me so we have something to cut to. So it doesn't look weird that I. So, but getting back to the three tenets. So we started with self, and we talked about, and we're just read this again. So we're getting back to the three tenets. The first was the self, and the one we're talking about now is the other, right? And that is just anything that is completely alien. And this is actually where horror works to its advantage when it's not when it's from a different culture. But this is actually where horror works to its advantage from being from different cultures. So I was bringing up the example of comedy from different cultures not making sense in across different cultures, right? The English joke doesn't land for the American audience, because the American audience doesn't understand. Right. When it comes to horror, that works to the advantage. That's one reason why a lot of J-horror is so popular. Because J-horror, a lot of it is rooted in Shinto mythology, which most Westerners don't know anything about.
I don't know anything about that.
Right. That's why it seems even creepier, because the less you know about it, the more it's the other. Right? So the other is pretty cut and dry. It's the monster. It's Godzilla. It's the thing from Cloverfield. It's I'm trying to think of another good example, but the one, monster from The Host.
Oh, I was gonna say that one, like, baby thing.
The uncanny is the things that are like us, but not quite, right? The idea of things being just a bit off. Anything that has that kind of used to be human, is what can really freak you out, right? It's one reason why zombie movies are so popular, because they're human, they're not, right? I was just watching Parasite Grey, right? The idea of, you know, the humans being co-opted and turned into a monster, that your friends could be foes. But more importantly, it's the idea of, like you're talking about the baby thing from Resident Evil, the thing that has that resemblance of humanity, or something that is hitting that uncanny valley.
That really-
But you've heard about the uncanny valley, right?
Yeah.
Right, where they try to
have an analog.
Right, where they try to make something as real as possible, but once you, at some point, you hit this threshold where you are either completely convincing, or it just looks, and you can't put your finger on why, right? Because the human brain is evolved to recognize the human face. It knows what the human face is. When you have like a cartoon, you know, like you're watching a Pixar movie kind of thing, you know, that's not a human face. So your brain doesn't try to make it a human face, but you can like, okay, we're going to pretend. But then you get to a point where it's close enough to a human face that your brain can no longer give you that benefit of the doubt, that suspension of disbelief, but not real enough that it can buy the illusion. That's the uncanny valley. And that's why that creeps us out, right? Because it's human, but not human. It's in that weird in-between. And if you hit that weird in-between, and again, that's one reason why the nurses in Silent Hill are so creepy. Because first of all, they're basically human, except they ain't got no face, point one. But look at the way they walk. Their knees are... They jerk. Right? That's just, you know, that's why that works. Because your brain wants to see a human being, but then it doesn't move like a human being. That is the ultimate short circuit in the brain. That is other examples of the uncanny. Imagine a row of streetlights, one of them keeps out, right? Because you know, but it just, that gives you that sense of dread, because not the way it be. I mean, that just hits our fight or flight instinct. Know something is wrong, even if we can't put our finger. So those are the three main tenets of psychological horror: the self, the uncanny, and the other. So when I'm developing my monsters for my stories, right now I'm working on my latest book, Fear, working title. We'll see if we keep it. I usually keep my working titles, but I'm not.
No. I think so.
Well, I mean,
that one's like,
is this supposed to be funny?
It is pretty funny.
Well, the Baby Eater has the advantage of getting people's attention, right? People.
It's called the Baby Eater. That's hilarious.
People see that and they either go, ooh, or they go, ew, one or the other. They don't, there's no shades of gray on that. Anyway, the point being is that in Fear, it's literally people's own worst nightmare coming to life. And so I'm having to deal with these three tenets of the psychological, right? Because, you know, getting your arm cut off, yeah, okay, yeah, that's gory, that's gonna, but seeing the things from your childhood nightmares come to life. So okay, a little bit of spoilery, right? One of the things I put in the book was something that gave me, and that was of the being Black Cat. This is how stupid this is, right? I saw this as a kid, and it was actually a dog's nightmare, right? The show that I was watching, the dog was having a nightmare. It was being chased by a, but it wasn't chased by a big giant black cat, because this was like made in the 60s. And it's not like they had CGI. So what did they do? They had a guy dressed all in black, wearing this big, huge, like, furry head of a black cat, chasing after him in ski, right? And the dog would dart right, and then he would ski around and cut him off, and the dog would dart left, and they can, and it was the dog's nightmare, right? But that character was so uncanny, because again, it's basically a person in a furry suit before furry suits were a thing on skis. This is how retarded this is. But as a kid, it freaked me the out, and I had nightmares of that giant 6 foot tall humanoid cat thing coming after me, just like it came after that Saint Bernard.
Huh. Like cat claw.
Yeah, with the big eyes and all.
Yeah, they're terrifying, aren't they? So suck.
Aren't those so creepy?
I go to Knott's, you know Knott's, dude. They have those at like for sale, and I'm like,
I know what to get you for Christmas. So let's ask this of our listeners, all like three of them. What terrifies you? What scares the crap out of you? I don't know. Well, maybe they can leave messages on the Spotify or comments on the YouTube video. I know they can do that. No, I don't know.
The spot is a five. Against the point, or you could, I don't know, create something on the website.
That is a good point. I think we're going to have to come up with an email.
Not an email? A forum.
A forum. What, like on Discord or something? Ew. Sorry, you tell me what is the hip way of communicating with our audience.
Hey, I'm a Discord fan, but hey, I can't. I use it for friendly week.
Well, I think this brings up a good point that we need to have a way for our viewers to give us feedback and talk to us back. So we're going to have to work on that. We're going to see if we can't get some mechanism for. So I think that's a good. We need our viewers to be able to tell us. It's not a big deal right now because we have like three of them, and I think we're related to all of them. But if this podcast grows, eventually we're going to want people to tell us things.
Right.
Like we suck.
Wow. And on that point, because we all very quickly ran out of time, we forgot to do our book review. And
I didn't forget. I just hadn't gotten to it yet.
Already late. So, you know. Look at that one time there. Look at that.
Yeah.
Hand me the book.
I'm old. I can't reach.
Today's book will be Bad Coma, written by blah, 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 blah. Let me see the name.
Paul Wilson. Gonna read the blurb on the back?
I don't want you to do it.
No, I can't read.
What? The true story of a Mexican soul trip from hell. The summer of 1978, 21-year-old Paul Wilson jumped at the chance to join local icons on a dream surf trip to mainland Mexico. Unaware of the ultimate destination lies in the heart of a drug cartel country. I'm being too fat. Have you know only idea of where he'll get the money to pay his share? In the tournament to prove his mettle, he does the only thing he can think of. He robs a supermarket. And if Karma didn't already have reason enough to doom the trip, he soon learns one of his companions is a convicted killer on the run, and the other is a unscrumptious cad. Mishap and misfortune rule the days, and mere survival takes precedent over surfing. Original photographs, including pre-Kingpin El Chapo. Dude, I'm half white and half Filipino. You can't expect me to get that. I was blanking.
Actually,
on
I
it.
Do.
I can't take it anymore. Anyways, and Wilson's strong narrative style combined to make this story truly personal. In the tradition of Into the Wild by John Crabbe.
Krakauer and Barbarian Days, A Surfing Life with William Finnegan, except this tale had to wait for the Statue of Limitations to expire before it could be told. Did you say unscrupulous? I think you meant unscrupulous.
I was reading fast.
Lord.
I was reading at like Mach 10 pace, dude.
We are a professional organization here.
Yeah, but okay. All right. You cut me some flack because, you know, I was reading at the speed of light.
Okay. Honest to God, we do not rehearse this because we thought it would be more fun for y'all to watch us fuck up, which he just did.
I was reading.
Spectacularly.
I was reading fast. I was reading at Mach 10. We're low on time. I'm reading fast. What do you want from me?
I don't know. For you to read at your grade reading, level?
I am reading so fast. My eyes are bulging out of their sockets. Okay? You do not know how fast I can read, how fast I can talk. I'm like...
Well, it's a good thing his surfing companion was unscrumpulous, because we don't want to have any cannibalism in this book.
Yeah, well, good. Good.
And to say that you cannot pronounce a Spanish name being half Filipino, you do realize that, you know,
okay,
your
was,
mother's maiden
was,
name is basically
I was
Spanish.
Fast. I was reading fast. My brain could not process because I was
your
reading.
Mother's maiden name has one has an Nye in it, you know, one that ends with a little squiggly line
yeah,
on
well,
the top.
Well, hear me out. How about next time I read his face so I can actually think, so my eyes don't bulge out of the
hey,
socket.
This was your choice. You're the one that ran through it as quick as
well,
possible.
Because we're low on time, Faiza.
It's our podcast. We can make it as long as we want. So if we're done bitching at each other, yeah, we'll talk about the book. Oh my God. Why do I feel I am in trouble now? How did that work?
We'll talk about this later.
I'm the father. We will talk about this later. So, bad karma. So, I met this guy at a book signing at Barnes & Noble, which, by the way, there's a trick to getting a book signing in Barnes & Noble I have not figured out how to do. Because I contacted the same store, and I can't get them to reply to me, but yet somehow he got in there. So, I don't know how.
Yes, Lord.
Huh?
Lord.
I'm trying to. Well, okay. I will tell you one thing that I did learn. Slight tangent about this. So I was trying to get a book signing into Barnes & Noble, and I published the books through various outlets. For example, I published through KDP. I also, when you buy them directly from our website, you're getting it from Lulu Press.
Lulu Press.
And I also publish through Barnes & Noble Press, because it was supposed to be, the idea is if enough people went to Barnes & Noble to order your book, they would start stocking it on the shelf, right? I also did it because at the time, they were the only way to I could do hardcover. I can do hardcover through Inkspark now. Amazon does hardcover, but it does it like this. It doesn't do it with the book jacket, right? This kind of thing with the book jacket. This you can do with Barnes & Noble Press, right? With Amazon, you can get kind of hard, solid cover, right? So my books, you can order it through this way with Amazon, or you can get it with a book jacket through Barnes & Noble, which I prefer. And when I sell them at the events, I actually order them through Noble. Again, one, because I think they look better. Two, because I want to hit whatever that magic number is, and they start stalking in the store. So I'm trying to do this book signing, and I did get one guy to talk to me. He says, well, we can't order your books because they did not have a return policy. In other words, if they order 50 books and they only sell 20, they want to be able to send the other 20 back and cut their losses, you know, and get their money back. And I'm like, but it's from Barnes & Noble Press. And they're like, yes, but it's print on demand, which means we can't return them. So Barnes & Noble could not stock the books from their own publication service.
Wow.
If that makes any sense. So the way I had to do it was I now have the books also available through Ingram Spark, because Ingram Spark has a return policy. So what happens with Ingram Spark is you basically are selling the book at cost. So as an author, if Barnes & Noble orders my book through Ingram Spark, I get like 15 cents. It's ridiculous. It's stupidly bad, right? Because Barnes & Noble wants to basically buy it at $10 and sell it for $20, right? Retail always wants to sell twice as much as what they paid for, right? Now, when they return it, because it's still print on demand, it basically gets shipped to me, and then I have to buy it. What happens, okay? But that now means that they can order the books and return them, and get their money back if they don't sell, right? So I did that in order to get the book signings in Barnes & Noble that I've still not been able to get. So I don't know how fucking Paul did it, but more power to him. I have not done that yet. But met him at the Barnes & Noble. I picked the book up mostly because as an independent writer, I wanted another independent writer. And I actually did not read this book. It sat on my shelf for a good couple years. And then we started doing this podcast. It's like, you know what? We have a whole library of books that are signed.
I picked it.
And I'm glad you did, because I actually really enjoyed this book. This is nonfiction, right? This, according to the author, it really happened, including at the end where he loses his van. It breaks down, and he has to go back to Mexico to go get it. And it's being held by this really nice guy that has this really strange nickname known as El Chapo. Which, as we now know, was a notorious drug lord that was arrested and extradited to the U.S. Was he extradited? I remember at one point there was a big old thing where he escaped and everything like that. I mean, dude's notorious. I mean, you can Google search him. He's got a history about a mile long. Right? But I mean, yeah, this was definitely a case of Murphy's Law. Anything that could have gone wrong did go wrong on this trip. And he was starting to think that basically he had just angered the gods, that he had but that first part where he's talking about the robbing the store to pay for it, that was so long. Right? Because he had this thing all planned out, and of course it didn't go according to the plan. And he's basically going to steal a bunch of stuff and sell it to his neighbors, right? They have this whole shopping list. And, of course, he's stealing stuff for his own thing. And his buddy's going to take it with the truck. Well, they overload the truck. And so he picked this route to avoid all the police. Nobody ever takes this route because of all the dips and the potholes and, oh, crap. So the truck that's already overweighted, hitting this pothole, bottoming out, and jars of tuna and peanut butter and beer are falling off the truck and landing on the ground and shattering, making all this noise. And so they're like literally leaving a trail of debris, leading the police right to them. And he's like, and at one point they have to go by the SEAL base. Right? And he's like, And then at one point, like, the cop car is following him, and then he's actually, like, thinking about, like, crashing his car just to create a diversion so his buddy would get away. And while he's thinking about it, the cop car goes around him, and he thinks he just blew it. But the cop car's got other things to do. And it's good. Somehow they pull this off, and it's just the funniest thing. I was laughing my ass off listening to that part of the book.
Yeah, it's... The audiobook was great. The person who read it was great. One thing I would love to say about this book, I think the characters were really fun to just enjoy, you know?
And I want to say that if you do anything in this book, I will kill you myself.
Okay. Yeah, go wild.
Yeah, no, this was, good Lord. I mean, yeah, it literally, the guy says in the book, is like, he was waiting for the statute of limitations to run out so he could tell the story, because some of the things that he did, not really meant to,
not the most legal.
No, he was definitely doing some of the gray areas in the law.
I'd say a little bit blackens.
Well, that was from the beginning. But I mean, it's just, yeah, no, it was just hilarious how everything that could go. Oh, remember the boat trip?
Yeah.
Like, oh my God. Because I've been in rough seas before. Right? Because I used to be in the Navy. I've been in rough seas before. I know what it's like to be, where you're basically, your whole world is just tossing and turning. There's not a damn thing you can do about it. And they're all getting seasick. They're trying to throw up, but the water is getting kicked up, and so it's coming back up through the toilet and coming back into the bathroom. And it's like, oh my God, it really is. Anything that could have gone wrong went wrong on that trip. It is, And what's funny is the main character is actually a good guy who is just really just had the worst luck. I mean, again, it does start off with some petty larceny.
Small amounts,
about 2 pallet full of crap. But for the most part, he's a good guy, and there's just like this camera he buys, and then he realizes later that the camera was stolen, and he's got like, well, what do I do with this, because, you know, I can't exactly find the people and return it, and I got all their film of all their vacation photos. What the hell do I do, you know? So I mean, the fact that he's dealing with these moral issues shows that the guy has morals, right? I mean, yeah. A crumb bum would have just went, huh, fuck it, toss it over the shoulder. I don't want to spoil it about what he did with it or anything like that, but the fact that he's dealing with these issues shows that even though he may not be making the best decisions, he does have a moral compass. Whether or not he follows it is another story. But he does have a sense of morality. He does have a sense of right and wrong. And he does sometimes struggle with that, which makes him not only a very compelling character, but again, the whole book is titled Bad Karma because he has a feeling that some of his bad choices were coming back to haunt him. That is the whole point of the book.
And with that, we've very not so graciously went a little very overboard of our time.
But editing's.
Wow. I think it's about time we bid you all adieu.
Well, before we go, let's tell them all where you can find us. Okay, first of all, real quick, let's go over the convention schedule.
Okay.
Oh, for fun. Wait, though. Give me 5 minutes. Come on, sit up. What's our first convention?
Son of Massapalooza.
Nope, that's not the first one. What's the first convention?
Massapalooza.
At?
Massapalooza.
When? May 31st.
May 31st.
June 1st and June 2nd. Okay, what's the next convention?
HorrorCon.
HorrorCon. That's going to be where?
Los Angeles.
Yep, the LA Convention Center. Okay, and that is going to be September, early part of September. Okay, what's after that?
Sonomasapalooza.
Nope. Got one more before. I know you want to skip to the end. What's after HorrorCon? It's like literally a week after HorrorCon. Creep IE Aftermath in Ontario.
Okay.
Okay, so we got both of those back to back in September. Then in October, we have. You got to be fucking. You're fucking with me now. What is the last.
Oh, Sonomasapalooza. Took me a minute.
God, that's like that joke on Wings.
Oh no, don't.
They're playing Trivial Pursuit and Lowell kept saying the same answer for every single question, no matter how obviously wrong it was. And he's like, why do you keep answering that? And he says, because I know the answer to one of these questions is that. And so by the end of the night, they finally asked a question where that was the answer, and they're looking at him to answer, and he's like, I got nothing. I don't know. Okay, can you quit fucking around so we can finish this up?
Yep.
Okay, so where can they find our books?
Audible, Amazon, iTunes. Our website. Barnes & Nobles.
There we go, okay. And also Ingram Spark.
Yeah.
So if you are a retailer, you can find our stuff through Ingram Spark. If you are a consumer or customer, you can find it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble. They're also available on Audible, on an audiobook on Audible and iTunes. We also have our own store at shopspectralink.com where you can buy our books. You can also buy our merch, such as these great t-shirts right here. We also have mugs, blankets, pillows. What are some of the crazier stuff we have in the store?
Bathing suits.
We do have bathing suits, yes. I don't think we got underwear. We don't have underwear. We do have a pair of shoes you designed.
Yeah.
So yeah, on the store, all of our merch is created by Printful, and I tell you, it is half the fun is just going around and seeing what print on demand stuff we can actually author. So it's a lot of fun.
Yeah,
just...
sometimes so crazy. So at this point, I'm like, okay, what can
including a pair of shoes that you designed. So yes, if you want the Alexander exclusive shoe. So with that, we're wrapping up this episode of the Indie Authors Podcast, the Indie Author Showcase. Try that again. So with that, we're wrapping up this episode of the Indie Author Showcase. Next week, what books are we going to talk about? Do we know the
Ben Todd?
He's going to be on the next, either the next one, or the one after that, and then what was the book that you just read? Don't remember the name. All right.
And what's the name of the book?
Oh, is it Windmare? I think we'll talk about that more next week. In fact, I'm hoping we get him.
Hopefully. And with that, in that thrilling conclusion, like a little cliffhanger, we bid you adieu.
We really need it now.
I'm sure we'll get it eventually. Today is not that day, though. Today is not that day.